All right, we're beginning here in the bottom of Chet Amud Bet on the last line. The Gemara here is continuing to discuss the question that was raised on Chet Amud Aleph, which is, what is the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim in the Mishnah with regards to Motzi Shemra? In the case of Motzi Shemra, Rabbi Meir says you can do it with 3 Dayanim, and the Chachamim say you have to do it with 23 Dayanim because it could end up as a capital case. So here the Gemara is trying to discuss what is the scenario, or what is the situation in which, first of all, Rabbi Meir would disagree with that. And number two is that the Chachamim have enough suspicion or enough evidence to say that we should keep 23 in this situation. So we already looked at 4 answers of the Amoraim. Yesterday we looked at Ula's answer, which is Chushin Lalaz. I mean, come if together, they're arguing about the suspicions or the aspersions that would be cast by the testimony. We saw the Machlok between the Benu Tam and Rashi. But Rashi says that we worry about new Edim showing up and giving us more evidence. The Rabbeinu Tam says we're worried about if the new Edim do come, and then we have to expand the Beit to 23, that that will cast aspersions on the first 3. Then we saw the position of Rabba, who indicated that the problem here is Mishum Kavod Rishonim. Do we worry about a Beit that started out with 23 and then is downgraded to 3? Do we worry about the Kavod Rishonim? Do we have to maintain the 23? Or is it enough that once you start with 23, you don't need them anymore, you can continue with 3? Do we worry about that? That was the next suggestion. Then we had the suggestion of Abaye, who took up the positions of Rabba and Ula and saying that everybody agrees, Choshishim Lalaz, everybody agrees that we worry about Kavod Rishonim, but the issue at hand is here is Atru Beistam, the case where they gave Hatra'ah without defining the death penalty that this person would be subject to. The question is, in that situation where Edim show up with that type of Hatra'ah, are we talking about a capital case? Or are we talking about a monetary matter? And that's a machloket between the Tanakama and Rabbi Yehuda and the Tosefta. And we applied that to the positions of the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir over here. And the last position that we looked at was Rav Papa's position, which spoke about a chaveira, isha chaveira, a woman who's knowledgeable, whether she requires hatra'ah or does not require hatra'ah. And so a similar scenario over here, we have Edim that show up that say there was no hatra'ah, but we do have testimony about the situation. Is that a capital case because Hatra is assumed because of the fact that she is knowledgeable and premised on the position of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Yehuda says that the whole purpose of Hatra'ah is to make a person move from Shogeg to Mezid? Or do we say that that doesn't work? You need active Hatra'ah. It doesn't matter whether the person is knowledgeable or not knowledgeable. And that was the machloket between them. So that's where we left off, 4 different possibilities of explaining that machloket. And today we'll plumb another 4 possibilities as to the answer to the machloki between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. So here we begin with Rav Ashi Amar, Kagon de Atru Bei Malkot, Lo Atru Bei Ktala. It's a case where the Edim warned that if you do this, you're going to be subject to Malkot, but you're not going to be subject to the death penalty. I mean, they warned about Malkot, and they didn't warn about Mita. Now, structurally in the Torah, anytime there's a death penalty in the Torah, the onesh that describes the death penalty must have a lav, must have a negative precept that comes before it. You have the lav, which is called the azhara, that is the warning, that is the precept that tells you you're not allowed to do this item. And then the onish is the repercussions of taking such an action. So every mitat beit din is comprised of those 2 components, which is the azhara, the warning not to do something, the negative precept, which tells you what the law is, and then the onish, which is the repercussion. There is a machloket, and you can see here both Rashi and Tosafot note this, that whether a lav shenitan laserat bitat beitin, if you have a lav, you have a negative precept that will result in a death penalty, does that lav on a standalone basis have the ability to obligate the individual or make culpable for malkot? Which is every lav or lotase involves malkot. When you have a mitat beitin, does the mitat beitin come and displace the malkot? Or does the mitat beitin come along and say, well, if there's the onesh of the mitat beitin, then that'll be the punishment. If there is no mitat beitin, then this should be like any other lav, and that lav will be subject to malkot. And so, obviously over here, according to this position of Rashi, you have to believe that the lav that is associated with the mitat beitin, or what is otherwise called a lav shenitan lahazarat mitat beitin, that you have to believe like the position that is lokin a lav. You can see that in the first line of Tosafot, and Rashi echoes a similar sentiment that you have to hold like that individual that believes that this lav is still subject to malkot. So now when the Edim gave warning about the malkot, but they didn't mention the mitah, that's the question. Now, Mikamiflagei bepukta the Rabbi Shmuel v'Rabbanan, and they now reflect the same machloket as Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbanan. It's done. Makot b'shloshat, it's in our Mishnah. When it comes to corporal punishment, how many dayanim do you need? We have the Tanakama who says that you only need 3. Mishum Rabbi Shmuel amru b'srim v'shloshat. Rabbi Shmuel says that if it requires corporal punishment, requires 23. And we discussed it in the Mishnah, the reasons behind that, and the Gemara itself will get involved in the Mishnah. The most important aspect over here is that Rabbi Shmuel's opinion with regards to the 23 of corporal punishment is that corporal punishment is part and parcel of the mitad beitin, maybe the lightest form of mitad beitin, but it's within that category of mitad beitin, which helps us over here because the case in the Mishnah is because it could be dinei nefashot. That's why the Chachamim say you need 23. Well, there's no nefashot here if you're speaking about corporal punishment, about makot. But the truth is that Rabbi Shmuel's position is premised on that, and the Yad Ramah notes that that's the reason over here that it's considered to be nefashot, even though we're speaking about makot. So makot between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is, in a case where the Edim told the woman that if she has this extramarital affair while she's in Arusa, that she's going to get makot. The truth is that the punishment according to the Torah is skila, but they didn't warn her for that. They only warned her for makot. In that case, are the makot given in a beitin of 3? Are those malkot given in a beitin of 23? That's the machlok in our Mishnah as to malkot. Is corporal punishment require 3 or 23? But again, it's all premised, or it is sitting on this position that there is such a concept as malkot when you deal with something that involves a death penalty, because the law itself that will require malkot when there's no mitat beitin. The next answer is offered by Ravina. Ravina Amar Kigon, Shenimsa Achad Men Eidim Karov U'Pasul. The situation in which we find one of the Eidim is a relative or is disqualified from being an aide. Obviously, we're speaking about here a situation in which there are more than 2 aidim. Say there are 3 aidim, 4 aidim. There are more than necessary aidim, and we find one of the aidim is problematic. How does that affect the remainder of the aidim? And they're arguing, Rabbi and the Chachamim, in the position of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi, in explaining the position of Rabbi Akiva. It's not. We have a Mishnah. Rabbi Kiva Omer, lo bahashlishi elalachmir alav. For this, we're going to see later on in our Masech, that we're going to see in the Makot, that there is an opinion that comes before this in the Mishnah, which is the opinion of Rabbi Shimon. And Rabbi Akiva is responding to that position of Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon says, ma shnaim einer agim achu shneim zomimim, af shlosha einer agim achu zomimim. It's premised on the Pasuk that says, so the question is, if 2 witnesses are sufficient, why do you need to tell me that 3 witnesses are sufficient? So the answer to that is la'kish. It's a big hekesh between the 3 witnesses and the 2 witnesses. Rabbi Shimon explains to us what that hekesh is. Just like by 2 witnesses, they are not made into edim zomimim until you disqualify both edim, meaning that the edim zomimim that come along testify about both edim, and tell us that they, manuaitem, you were with us, and therefore you can't testify. And if they only do that to one of the edim, then there is no hazama over here. Hazama has to be of the entire kat, the group of edim. And over there it's 2. If 3 come along, what Rabbi Shimon says is that 3 have the same status as 2. They become a unit, and therefore, until you are mazim the entire unit, there won't be edim zomimim over here. So just like by 2, you require both of them to be edim zomimim before they are punished, so to over here, by 3, you need all 3 of them to be designated as Eidim Zomimim before you'll punish the entire Kat. If one of them is not classified as an Eid Zomim, then the remaining 2, even though they're found to be Eidim Zomimim, they won't be punished because the 3rd one was not found to be an Eid Zomim. So that's how Rabbi Shimon explains it. On that, Rabbi Kiva says, Lo bashlishi elachmir alav, that the 3rd one is not implied in his statement coming to be Mekil, but rather to be machmir. So dino kiyotze beilu, to say that he will end up in the same position as the others. Im kein anasha katuv et anitval ofrei avira. If this is the way the Torah punishes those people that join and aid and abet evildoers, keofrei avira, they're punished just like the evildoers themselves. Al chat kama v'kama shishalem schar. So of course Hashem will then pay the rewards et anitval osei mitzvah kosei mitzvah, for someone who joins or participates in a mitzvah like the actual doers of the mitzvah itself. So what Rabbi Kiva is pointing out over here is that it's sufficient in the Eidut to have 2 witnesses over here. The 3rd person is completely unnecessary in order for the case to go forward, because we only need two witnesses and not three witnesses. And what Rabbi Akiva is saying over here is the chumrah is that this third witness will be subject to the same as the other two witnesses. And so what Rabbi Akiva then says is, well, if that's what happens to a third wheel, when they're not necessary, they're going to get punished or caught up in the problems of the other two, then certainly when the positive side, when we're dealing with mitzvot, and as Rashi points out over here, that midah tovah merubah mibidah purunahut, that we know that the good rewards of God far exceed in multiple amounts the evil or the punishments that he grants, and that's based off of the psukim in the Aseret HaDibrot, as the four generations for punishment and 2,000 for reward. And so there's that 500 multiple between them. And so that's the Kal Vachomer, that if it's applicable by the negative side, it'll also be applicable by the positive side. And therefore, even if it wasn't your idea, even if it wasn't your mitzvah, but you joined the Chabura, you became a partner with them, even though you weren't necessary for it, then you will garner a reward along with those individuals who are the primary movers in doing the mitzvah. So that's the statement of Rabbi Akiva. The question about what Rabbi Akiva means and how he argues on Rabbi Shimon is very difficult to understand. He says over here that he's coming l'hachmir velo l'hakel. He's coming to be machmir, this third witness, and not to be the hakel, not to be makel on the third witness. Does that mean that he's rejecting Rabbi Shimon? And that Rabbi Akiva would believe that even if two of those witnesses are found to be zomimim, they would be classified as zomimim, or maybe even the third one would be also classified as an eid zomim. So if you look further on in the Masechta on Daf Mem Aleph Amud Bet, Rashi over there explicitly says that Rabbi Akiva accepts the position of Rabbi Shimon. And he says that, even though the Gemara here quotes Rabbi Akiva as saying something that is attributed to Rabbi Shimon in the Gemara in Makot, in the Mishnah in Makot, nevertheless, Miu, Rabbi Akiva, itlay nami de Rabbi Shimon. Rashi over there says that Rabbi Akiva is built upon Rabbi Shimon, umosif ihu. And then he adds on top of that, meaning that Rabbi Akiva is more machmir. He, on top of Rabbi Shimon's statement, says that there's something more than what Rabbi Shimon says. But according to Rashi, it's clear that Rabbi Akiva accepts the position of Rabbi Shimon. Ekronit, the Balei Tosafot, there also Manalva and Bet, quote the Rashi. They say that it seems that Rashi is correct about that, but we have some problems with that because it doesn't really fit into the wording. The wording seems to indicate that this is Rabbi Akiva's opinion, even though we know this as Rabbi Shimon's opinion. And so why would they make it Rabbi Akiva's opinion if it's Rabbi Shimon? They just quote Rabbi Shimon. So therefore, the Balei Tosafot come up with a distinction over there on Mem Aleph Amud Bet between the position of Rabbi Akiva and the position of Rabbi Shimon. That is, in a situation in which the third witness says, Eini Yodea. It's a situation which the three witnesses come, and then they're questioning the three witnesses, and one of the witnesses says, Eini Yodea. That Eini Yodea will disqualify that witness. And the question is, what's the impact of that disqualification on the other two witnesses? Aval Amar, Eini Yodea, this is what Tosafot says over there, Kishinimsa Chameyam Karovu Pasul Dami. It's the equivalent of finding them, one of them, to be a relative or a pasul. Dil Rabbi Shimon titkayim ha'idut bashar. According to Rabbi Shimon, then the other two witnesses will carry out the testimony and will drop the one that is problematic. Ule Rabbi Akiva idutan b'teila. And according to Rabbi Akiva, the whole thing is lost then. V'ayinu d'kama Rabbi Akiva. And that's what it means over there, that Rabbi Akiva. So there, the Balei Tosafot suggests that the difference between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Akiva is not only what we're going to see here in 1 second about a karov and a pasul, but even in a case where you have three witnesses and one of them says Eini Yodea, that deems them to be similar to a karov and pasul. And in that case, Rabbi Shimon will say, we drop the karov and pasul and just work forward with the kosher edim. Rabbi Akiva says, no, that's the problem here. The three edim, the nitzvah le'over ve'ira, makes them into a chumrah. And therefore, his problems become the problem of the whole kat, and he will disqualify the whole kat edim. That's the Balei Tosafot over there. The Balei Tosafot over here speculated, bring a line, which they don't accept in the end. Other Rishonim do accept it. And they say over here, Umatzi the Meimar, and from here it seems, the Poligad Rabbi Shimon, that Rabbi Akiva argues on Rabbi Shimon, Bisirle Dineharagin, that Edim Zomimim will be killed, Apopi Shenshlo Shtam Zomimim, even though all three of them have not been made into Edim Zomimim. Tegamar Ein Lakish Lashad Shnaim Linyazet. Because he says, you don't do it the Kula, only the Chumra. So, it'll be the Chumra that one of them can disqualify all of them, but on the other side, it will not protect them. If you have three Edim and two of them are found to be Edim Zomamim, they will be killed like any other case of Edim Zomamim, and the third one will not protect them. The Balei Tosafot backs away from this position, but it is the position of other Rishonim, like the Ritva and the Ran, and others who suggest that that is the case over here, that we really do believe that Rabbi Akiva argues fundamentally on Rabbi Shimon, and disagrees that you all need all three of them to become Edim Zomamim, in order for them to be disqualified. There is even a position that suggests that you could go as far, and you could probably read this into the words of Balei Tosafot. He doesn't state himself, but you could see how it would fit in the Gemara, that if two of them are found to be Edim Zomamim, that the third guy is killed, even though he's not found to be an Edim Zomamim, because he's Ed Nitfal the Ovrei Aveira. It's an extreme opinion. It's brought by the Ritz Geut. But the possibility of reading that into the words of Rabbi Akiva argue on the Rabbi Shimon. In our Gemara here, the Balei Tosafot bring a distinction in the following manner. And that is that what happens if the three of them show up in court? How do they become joined as a single kat edim? So what Rabbi Akiva is arguing on Rabbi Shimon is, Rabbi Shimon believes they can only become a single kat edim if they all testify betoch kadei dibur. They all testify within a string of time, which makes them into a single entity because of the proximity of their testimony. The other hand, Rabbi Akiva believes, unlike Rabbi Shimon, that you could add in another party later on. If a person comes and testifies, so just like the first two were part of this kat, this first person is now added into the kat, even though he came at a later time. And Rabbi Akiva kavar shenenash, avu bishba kachar kach minakat nitfal. Rabbi Akiva says that the nitfal, meaning that he's secondary, he was added on. He's an addendum, an appendix to the original edim, means that he can be added into the fray after the fact. And so therefore he could be subject to the punishment even though he came later. So according to Rabbi Shimon, they will only be subject to the death penalty if all three of them come together and then are found to be Zomamim. Rabbi Akiva says that the third guy, even though he showed up much later, according to Rabbi Shimon, that guy is not meaningful, and therefore he'll never be considered an Eid Zomim or killed as an Eid Zomim. As for Rabbi Akiva, he'll be joined with the first two. And then if they're all found to be Edim Zomamim, they will all be killed in that instance. Those are a potpourri of different views in the Rishonim as to what Rabbi Akiva's position is vis-a-vis Rabbi Shimon. Does he agree fully with Rabbi Shimon? That was Rashi. Does he disagree in nuanced manners that we saw both in the Tosafot and Mem Aleph? We spoke about the case of Eni Odea. And over here we spoke about the possibility of adding him in past Toch Kadei Dibor. And then we saw the more extreme positions of the Ritva the Ran, who suggests that even two out of three could be made into Zomamim, according to Rabbi Akiva, and then the Ritz Geut, who says the two could then force the third one to be killed, even though he's not found to be an Eid Zomim. What we're speaking about here is Rabbi Akiva's position itself, which is with regards to a Pasul. If we find one of the Edim to be a Karov Upasul, what happens in that case? So, Nama Nimtz Shnayim Nimtza Echad Mehem Karov Upasul Edutam B'Teila. Just like by two, if you find one of them is disqualified because he's a relative or he is unable or disqualified from testifying, then the other one falls away as well. The whole kat edim falls apart. Af shlosha. So too, when you have three edim, nimtza echad mehem karov pasul, edutan b'teila. If you find one of them to be problematic, he ruins it for all three of them. Uminayin shafilu meya. How do you know if they all come as 100, a unit of 100 individuals, and one of them is problematic, that they all then are disqualified? Tamalomar edim, meaning that in the plural sense. It's not just two or three, it's any number of edim. As long as one of them is problematic, it will ruin it for everyone else. So now, that is the position of Rabbi Akiva as opposed to Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon says that yikayim bashar, you dump the one who's problematic, and then you uphold the position with the remaining edim that are kasher. Rabbi Akiva disagrees, and that's what he's saying over here, that the shlishi is the achmir. The Shushin comes along and ruins it for everyone else. He doesn't just get thrown out. He actually causes problems for everyone else. And therefore, they're all disqualified. That disqualification is now qualified by the following statement. And that's what the Gemara was after. Amar Rav Yossi, Bamed Dvarim Amurim. When is that true? Bidine Nefashot. That's when you're talking about capital crimes, capital cases. Aval Bidine Mimonot, Titkayim Ayidut Bashar. When it comes to monumentary matters, we will allow the remaining two edim to uphold the testimony. So what Rabbi Yossi claims in the position of Rabbi Akiva is that Rabbi Akiva only believes that the third one ruins it for everyone in capital cases, and the reason being, as Rashi notes over here, because there's a requirement of Itzilo Eida. There's a requirement by capital cases to look out for the benefit of the litigant and try to do anything to to find him innocent or to acquit him in the case. And so this would be one of those instances where we find one of the edim disqualified will disqualify the rest. There's no such requirement by dinei memonot, mostly because one side wins, one side loses. So you can't say it's for the benefit of one because that'll always be to the detriment of the other. And therefore over there, we would not say that and we would just drop the problematic eight and we'll say the other two will carry the day. Rabbi Omer, echad dinei memonot ve'echad dinei nefashot. Doesn't matter. According to Rabbi Akiva, whether it's a monetary case or whether it is a capital case, one is disqualified, it ruins it for everyone else. Meaning that we consider them to be a single entity of edim, whether it's dinei fashot, whether it's dinei memonot, and then edutam b'teila, it destroys or annuls their testimony completely because they have a problematic individual involved here. So now, ve'ematai, Rabbi says over here, when is this true? He qualifies this. Bizman shehitru b'ahed. A time when there was hatra'ah involved. The Baalei Tosafot go on to say that this isn't only true for Rabbi, it's also true for Rabbi Yossi as well. But there is a requirement here, or basically this is the trigger or threshold for determining whether you are a single katedim or you're not a single katedim. How do we know that you become a unit of testifiers versus individuals who are testifying or in a situation where you've witnessed something, but you are not part of these edim that are coming to testify? What is that glue that brings them together? The answer here is shehitru b'hen, that there was hatra'ah. Rashi reads that is, shegilu datam shavim nasim edim. The hatra'ah is here when the edim engage the party that they are warning, and they give them a hatra'ah. The fact that they engaged the party and gave a warning shows that they intend to testify over here, or they are considering themselves a deem in this case. Given that, they now become an entity or a deem, whether they like it or not, because they warned, and each individual warned over there, then joins themselves into the edut, and that edut now will become a unit, and if one of them is problematic, it will ruin it for the others. That's the way Rashi learns it. If you look in the beginning of the Tosafot, he quotes from the Gemara Makot and says the Hatra'ah is the following. Hachaminolohu. They come to court, the court asks them, Lasude achitu, o lemechse achitu. When you witness the event, were you there to be a witness? Or were you there just simply to watch and be a spectator? So the question is, are you a spectator or are you a witness? And the person has to declare themselves a spectator or a witness, and that will determine as to whether they are a part of this katedim or not part of this katedim. So Rashi sees the hatra'ah being the warning to the party itself. Whereas Tosafot sees the warning or the hatra'ah, meaning that Beit Din asks them what their intent was in this case. Now, you could see differentiating, maybe splitting between dinei menefashot and dinei memonot in this. Because by dinei menefashot, there is a need or necessity for hatra'ah. There is a guilty party who you are warning. By memonot, hatra'ah is not really relevant, and then maybe the view of the Baalei Tosafot would make more sense. So you could see taking Rashi's opinion and applying it to the dinei menefashot, and the Tosafot's opinion applying to dinei memonot, they believe that it's true in both, and then obviously for Rashi it's a little difficult, but the case of dinei memonot, but here they applied to both, but nevertheless that you could see splitting the opinion and saying one is applied to dinei memonot and one is applied to dinei nefashot. Aval, b'zman shlo hitru b'hen, if there lacks hatra'ah, ma yasu shnei achim ve'achad shehu be'achad sheraged ha'nefesh? What happens if you have three individuals witness a murder? Two of them are brothers. So now, automatically, the murderer is off the hook because there were two brothers standing there that witnessed the event. Is the witnessing of the event itself enough to generate the glue that brings them together as a katedim? If that's the case, anytime you have relatives involved in a situation that are witnessing an event, automatically there will be no witnesses to the event because everybody then will be considered witnesses and there will be a karov or pasul involved, and that will disqualify all these edim. So what Rabbi is pointing out is that's an impossible situation. So there must be a way to define the edim. The way that you define the edim is through hatra'ah. Whether that's the question of Beit Din, whether you were a spectator or a witness, whether that's the edim themselves giving a warning to the party, declaring themselves edim in the case. So now, this is the machloket between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. That's what Rashi explains over here. The situation, gon shenimsa achad mishlosha karov pasul. The case where one of the three edim that showed up was a karov pasul. Vira'ah v'shatak. They witnessed the event. V'shatak v'lo hitra. They were silent and they did not warn. Rabbi Meir savar la k'Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Meir holds like Rabbi Yosi, Damar b'dinei nefashot, lo shna hatra, lo shna shatak, edutan b'teila. He holds like Rabbi Yosi that it doesn't matter whether there was a warning. Doesn't matter if they were silent. Their edut is b'teila. V'rabbonon savre, and the Rabbanon hold, like Rabbi, that when you're silent, your edut remains intact, and the problematic aid falls away is not a problem. So according to the Chachamim, we have a capital case over here, because the third witness never gave the warning, according to Rashi. For Rashi, at least, the question is, did they engage with Hatra'ah or not? According to Rabbi Yossi, it doesn't matter. They're automatically disqualified by being together. Rabbi says that leads you to a ludicrous situation. And therefore, Hatra'ah has to be the determining factor, and here there was no Hatra'ah. So the Chachamim believe, like Rabbi, that if there's no Hatra'ah, you're not joined to the group. If that's the case, the Karov Basul is dropped, and then the case will go forward with the other two Edim. Rabbi Meir will say, I hold like Rabbi Yossi, who says that even if there is no Hatra'ah over there, the three are joined together, you have a Karov Basul as part of the group, they disqualify everyone else, because here we're talking about a capital case. There's going to be a death penalty for this young woman who had an extramarital affair. And therefore, the case continues with three as a monetary matter, and not as a capital crime, because there are no edim here. The aid pasol ruined it, or the aid karov ruined it for everyone else. So that's the way Rashi learns. Now, as far as what is the qualification, or where does that point in time happen, that an aid becomes an aid? So here, the Balei Tosafot deal with it. We actually spoke about it back in Baba Batra, because over there, the Rashbam had an unusual position, which the Balei Tosafot disagreed with, and Rashi over here seemingly also disagrees with that position of the Rashbam. But the Rashbam over there says that an aid can become an aid by simply witnessing, by simply being there and seeing the event. They automatically garner a status of aid. And that has implications for Ein Aid Naseh Dayan, that once you're a witness, you're not allowed to be a judge in a case. What makes you into a witness? According to the Rashbam, witnessing the event makes you into a witness. The Rashbam's proof is from Kiddush HaChodesh, where the Gemara seems to say over there that if the Beit HaGadol, if their members saw the moon, enecha shmiya gdola miriya. Obviously, seeing is better than hearing, and so they have no better a testimony than that case. And so there you see that just the mere witnessing of the event makes you into an aid. And then the Gemara says over there that three of them have to break away and come and testify before the rest of the Beit Din. So you see that Ein Eid Naseh Dayan is even when they just simply witness the event. So there the Balei Tosafot and Baba Batra already deal with why they think the Rashbam's proof is wrong. He discusses it a little bit here as well. But the Rashbam believes that that witnessing makes you into an aid, and then you can't become a Danayan. Or in a situation where you have this Karova Pasul, the simple witnessing of the event will disqualify the entire Kat Edim. On the other hand, Balei Tosafot here indicate that you only become an aid when you come and testify in court. That's what makes you into an aid. And that's what the Tosafot says over here. The Hatra'ah that we're discussing over here is the court's question. Did you see the event in order to be a witness? And they're now coming to tell us or testify about that. Or did you simply were a spectator to the event and you did not plan on being a witness? And that's the Hatra'ah. That's the question that's being asked. But in the end, you only become an aid once they enter Beit Din. As we says here in near the read, Mishum Ditkavnu La'id, Lo Aminim Nitzer Achar Mehem Karov Pasul Adetam B'Teila. By the simple fact that they declare their intent to do something, that's not enough. El Shochim U'Me'idim Kulam B'Beit Din. They must actually testify in Beit Din. Aval Mishum Riyah L'Chud. Just by witnessing or being a spectator, Shnitkavnu La'id. Even if they intended to testify, that's not enough. Dilo Teim Achachi. If you don't say that, because then any get that's given amongst with a bunch of relatives standing around and watching it, then the get would be pasul if one of those relatives wants to be a witness or thinks that he's going to be a witness. And then according to Rabbi Yossi, you don't even need the kavana. You could just be standing there and that would be it. It'll wreck everything for you. So what's the problem with two brothers that witness event? That's what Tosafos is discussing here, a case in the Gemara. It's a case that they may show up unbeknownst to each other and testify in court, and that'll cause the problem. But their mere witnessing of the event is not sufficient. That a witness cannot become a dayan. Only if you testify, not if you saw it. Only if you testify can you not become a dayan. Even if you intend to testify, lo, that doesn't disqualify you. That time, a dayan aid said in a dayan. What's the reasoning behind why an aid cannot become a dayan? So Tosafot brings two reasons for that. Yira omishum debina an edut shatayochola zima. It has to be a testimony that can be undermined by other edim coming along and saying mimanu aitem. That would require the judge to accept the testimony of the other witnesses. Well, if the judge himself was the witness, and then other people are coming along and are going to cause him to be an eid zomeim, he's just not going to accept their testimony. So that's why ein eid nesed dayan. Or the other possibility is because it says vamdu shnei anashim, and it says that the two people which are the eidim must be stand lifnei Hashem before God, which is the dayanim. So the two witnesses have to stand before the dayanim, and you can't do that if you're an eid and a dayan. So it's a technical problem. It's a gzeret hakatu, and that causes the problem. But both of those are only true when they actually are testifying, when they actually have testified in person. If they haven't testified in person, there's no question about hazama, because until they've testified, then you can't have edim zomimim. And similarly, the gzeret hakatuv only applies when you have witnesses that are actually testifying. And therefore, ein ed nase dayan is also only in a situation in which edim actually testified, and as he points out now, that's not like what the Rashbam says in Baba Batra. And then Tosafot in the end, Umiyu, he says near the Rashba, that the Rashmi Shantz believes that, according to Rabbi Yossi, Al-Korchach Leitleish Yaseh Eid Biriyah, that he can't believe that an aid just by citing is going to turn into an aid and become a Kiat Eidim. V'afilu Yaid Basof, even if he comes and testifies in the end, that can't make him into aid. Rabbi Yossi Udamar, Achyu Pishne Eidim Metrinbo, Kedamar B'samuch, Ukumosh Shnaim En Yocholim Lalid, Elim Kimitrubo. Rabbi Yossi himself is going to say, we're going to see it upcoming in the Gemara, that Eidim themselves have to give the Hatra'ah. You can't have the Hatra'ah come from other parties. The Eidim have to be the people who warn over here. And so if that's the case, then even for Rabbi Yossi, there is a requirement in order to be an aid that you're the one who's matreh. V'chein nirad v'rim di muzmukulam lo yun yaragim otan shlohi trubo. That those people that didn't give Hatra'ah, they would not be killed in the case of Eidim Zomimim. V'lo mahani sa'udutayu b'lo sa'duta achrinei. Because their testimony is worthless without the testimony of the other parties. But then Rabbi, wasn't he the one who introduced Hatra over here? How do you deal with then that Rabbi Yossi doesn't say that? It's not because Rabbi Yossi doesn't require it. Because for Rabbi, it's just enough if they intend to testify. That's enough to make them or disqualify them in that case if they come and testify. For Rabbi Yossi, they actually have to give Hatra'ah. And so that's the difference between them, or basically what he's saying is it's the difference between Rashi and the Tosafot. Rashi says you need active Hatra'ah. That's, according to him, the view of Rabbi Yossi, according to Rashmi Shantz. And the view of Rabbi is you don't need active Hatra'ah, you just need intent. Like when Beit Din asked you, did you want to testify? The answer is yes. So then when you do come and testify, you'll be joined in with the Eidim. And that's the difference between Rabbi and Rabbi Yossi. And then once again, that would be the machloket over here between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Depends. What type of Hatra'ah was given? Was it an active Hatra'ah? Was it that they intended to testify, or was it they didn't intend to testify? So that difference between the opinions of Rabbi Yossi and the Rabbi will determine. Rabbi Yossi, you need active Hatra'ah, and since there was a lack of active Hatra'ah over here, there's disqualified this aid, and he's not going to ruin the rest of the Edim. And according to Rabbi, since it was his intent to testify, that'll be enough to include this aid in the case and to make him into a real aid if he comes and testifies. And therefore he's a karov pasul, you ruin it for everyone else. So that'll be the machloket between them. That is the view of the Baal Tosafot. But other Rishonim do believe that individuals who become witnesses, despite the fact that they did not come and testify, and despite the fact that they weren't invited to testify, their mere witnessing of the event with the intent to become a witness could be disqualifying to the other witnesses. The Rosh HaMakot says that if an individual invites particular witnesses to come to testify on his behalf in court, and then other witnesses to the event show up, those other witnesses are not considered to be valid, and they now cannot disqualify the edim that that particular individual asked to come to testify in court on his behalf. And that is because his designation of those Eidim to be the Eidim then eliminates all the other Eidim, even though they witnessed the event. But because he designated them and asked them to come to testify, that's enough to preclude the other Eidim. On the other hand, the Rambam believes the mere witnessing of the event then gives you the right to testify and invalidate the other witnesses. It's very similar to the position of the Rashbam that we saw in Baba Batra and that the Baal Tosafot quote over here, that mere witnessing or seeing of an event makes you into a witness to that event. As long as you intend to be a witness at the time that you see the event, then that could disqualify all the other Edim. And that view of the Rashbam and the Rambam presents a serious issue when it comes to events like Kiddushin, like a marriage. In a case where you have a marriage and they call up Edim in order to be witness to the Kiddushin, over there you have hundreds of people standing around watching the event, some of them relatives, some of them disqualified witnesses, some of them Rishaim. If according to the Rambam they intend to testify about this event or witness this event, that could disqualify the real Edim there, and then you have no Edim Kiddushin left. So how do you deal with such a situation? So many of the modern-day poskim quote the Tzot HaChoshen, who says that even the Rambam will agree that if at the time the event is taking place, you designate Edim to be the Edim, that will disqualify or invalidate all other Edim, or disconnect them from the event. Because the Rambam believes that the thing that brings the Edim together is the witnessing of the event itself. The Rishonim, like the Balei Tosafot, believe that it's only once you come and testify in court does that make you into an official witness. But even for the Rambam, who believes that the witnessing of the event is what brings you together, if at the moment of the event you make sure to designate or delineate Edim separately and say you will be the Edim for this event, that will preclude others from becoming witnesses to that event. And therefore, many say, at the time that they're doing the Kiddushin, the Mesader Kiddushin will say that the husband-to-be should say to the witnesses, you are my witnesses to this Kiddushin, to the exclusion of all other parties over here. So the Koshin goes on to say that you might not even have to articulate that point, because by definition, the Edim, by the case of Gitin and Kiddushin, are different than Edim in other places. We've spoken about this in many instances. They are Edei Kiyum versus Edei Raya. That normally when you have witnesses, you're looking at an event, and the looking at the event is in order to testify about that event in the future. That's not true by Kiddushin. The witnesses by the Kiddushin are what make it into Kiddushin. They are Edei Kiyum. They make the Kiddushin into an effective Kiddushin. Nothing about the fact they're going to testify in the future, simply their presence at the event is what gives significance to the event. So those types of Edim are different than Edei Raya or Edim that will testify, because since they will testify in the future, their being Edim is about their testimony, that's what can join them together. But by Kiddushin and Gerushin, the Edim are there are not there to testify, and therefore other Edim who want to testify can't automatically join in with them. Now, V'Vayitema, now we have a seventh option, as to explain the Machloket here between Rav Meir and the Chachamim, Kagon, Shehitru Ba Acherim, V'lo Hitru Bo Edim. This is what the Rosh Mishatz was referencing to for Rabbi Yossi, which is, here is a case where the Hatra was given by other parties besides the Edim who are testifying about the capital crime that took place. The Kamifle gave a pluk to Rabbi Yossi Rabbonon, and Rav Meir and the Chachamim are arguing this Machloket Rabbi Yossi and the Rabbonon, that's not. Rabbi Yossi Omer Lo'olam Inu Ne'arag, Achiu Pishnei Dav Matrin Bo, that the same Edim that testify about the capital crime, they witnessed the crime, they have to be the same individuals who gave the Hatra'ah. Shenemar al Pishnei Edim. Two Edim are able to put a person to death. It must be two Edim and solely those two Edim. They themselves have to be the full testimony here. That includes Hatra'ah and the witnessing of the event itself. If you bifurcate that and give the Hatra'ah to one instead of another Edim, and they testify as to what happened, they can't be joined together because that's not Alpi Shnayim Edim anymore. That's Alpi Arba Edim. And that's not the way it works, according to Rabbi Yossi. So therefore, in a case where you have Hatra'ah by other parties, that's the Machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. Rabbi Meir will say that, like Rabbi Yossi, you have to have the Edim give the Hatra'ah. And here, where the Hatra'ah is given by other Edim, we will say that it's not a capital case, and that's why you do three judges. The Chachamim say, unlike Rabbi Yossi, like the Rabbanan, that Hatra'ah can be given by other Edim, and therefore this is a capital case, and that's why you need 23 over here. And then the Gemara now offers a eighth and final option as to what the Machlokes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim is. V'Vayitema, Gon Deit Kachush Bebitikot, V'Loit Kachush B'Hachakirot. We're going to see later on in the Masechta that when it comes to Dinei Nefashot and the cross-examination of the Edim, that there are sets of questions that they must answer. Some of those are called bedikot, and some of those are called chakirot. Chakirot are the core questions that are asked that determine the location, the time, the parties involved, meaning that these are key pieces of information that without them, we will not accept the testimony of the witnesses, because number one, it establishes the crime and all the parties to the crime and where it was located. It also allows those edim to have other edim come and be mezim them, because now they can say, Imanu Aitim, you weren't there at that time, you weren't there at that location, you didn't see, you weren't with that individual. I mean, that information allows other edim to come and be mezim them. Those are Geruchaki wrote. And we'll see the nature of those questions later on in the Masechta. Bidikot are additional questions that clarify details of the case. So now, what happens if you find that the two edim, you separate them, and then you start questioning them? If they are not reconciled on any of the chakirot, the testimony is thrown out. Because those are so basic to the case and the witnessing of the event that they must have the same information and same testimony with regards to that. They need to give you the same time, the same day. They have to give you the same parties involved, the same weapon. All the things that are involved have to be similar between them. And if there's any discrepancy between them, they do this thrown out with regards to chakirot. On the other hand, bibidikot is a machloket. Those additional questions that are asked, they're for clarification. They are for us to check more about the edim. But what happens if there's a disagreement between the edim about some of these details? Do we say that then their edut is thrown out? Or do we say that people don't pay attention to such detail? It's just too detailed, and they didn't know about that. They know the main issues. They don't know these types of detailed answers to the question. Or in a case where a person says, Eini yodea, I don't know. In the case of the chakirot, if you say Eini yodea, you're automatically disqualified and the edut drops. In the case of bidikot, if you say Eini yodea, what's the status? Are bidikot so essential that if you say Eini yodea, you're thrown out? Or do we say that bidikot are just, we call it extra credit. They're a way to cross-examine the edim, but they're not core essential to this cross-examination of the edim. So that'll be the machloket here. V'kamifage v'plukta ben zakai v'rabonon. It'll be the same machloket as between ben zakai and rabonon. It's not. We have a mishnah maseh u'badak ben zakai b'ukseh te'inim. That ben zakai checked out the edim with not only where the murder took place, under the fig tree, with this weapon at this time. He asked them the figs that were hanging from that tree, what type of okets did they have? What type of ends did they have? Were they thick or they thin? Meaning that it was a very, very detailed question, which many of the edim would not capture or would not get. And he disqualified the edim based on that. So Ben Zakai took pride in the fact that he was able to come up with a question or a detailed question that disqualified the edim. And he was doing hitzilu et ha'edah. So Ben Zakai believes that even in these types of detailed questions, you could disqualify the edim. The Rabbonah disagree with Ben Zakai on that point. And that will be the machloket here between the Rebbe Meir and the Chachamim, is a situation in which there's a problem in the bedikot. If there's a problem in the bedikot, does that disqualify these edim? And therefore, we're dealing with a monetary case now, not a capital case. That's Rebbe Meir's opinion, like Ben Zakai. And therefore, you only need three judges. On the other hand, for the Chachamim, who believe that in that situation, they'll hold like they're Rabbonon, that they're not disqualified. The edut is still a good edut. We're still dealing with a capital case, and therefore you'll need 23 judges in that instance. Now, the Baalei Tosafot over here say Tema. We already discussed it a little bit yesterday, but here he asked the question, the Mashmid Kaya Abaye, that all the answers here, after Abaye comes and gives the third answer, every subsequent answer, Rashi said this, and the Baalei Tosafot indicated that that most likely is true, and here they say it explicitly, is that they are relying or leaning on Abaye. Abaye made two statements. One statement is that, Choshishin Lalas, we worry about the discrediting of the judges, and also that we are Choshesh Le Kavod Rishonim, that if you started out with a larger Beit Din, we don't reduce the Beit Din. Over here, Tosafot says, Demash Mekai Abaye, Damar Kuliyama Choshim Lalas. And he says over here, according to Rebbe Meir, then you would also need 23 over here. If you're choshesh for las, then why isn't there a possibility that new edim will show up? So even though these edim got disqualified over these details, it doesn't mean that these, first of all, edim are liars. It also doesn't mean that there aren't other edim out there that will come and testify about this matter. And therefore, Rebbe Meir should also be choshesh the las, and then we should continue to adjudicate, or we should have to adjudicate the case with 23 dayanim. If that's the case, then the machloket between Ben Zakkai and the Chachamim is somewhat meaningless here because it's all because of Choshen Laz. Everybody would agree you need 23. So Tosfot over here comes up with numerous answers how to deal with it. He says, one of the answers he gives is that these Edim testified that there were no other Edim witnessing it. So now we know there are going to be no new Edim that come. And then Tosfot gives other possibilities about how you have a situation in which we're not Choshesh Laz, but we are Choshesh for the disqualification of the Bidikot. But those are just pointing out that you have to be careful because this is built upon Abaye, and you have to make sure that Abaye doesn't automatically bring you to a case of 23, whether or not the Machloket Ben Zakkai or Rabbanan is applied. And that's what he's trying to do, is figure out what that case is. Again, I gave you the first answer that he gives over here, which is that these Edim say there were no other Edim, so there's no longer Hoshim Lalaz. But he does give a number of other possibilities about how you could come up with such a scenario where we wouldn't have a problem with Hoshim Lalaz, or Kavod Rishonim, and nevertheless, you'd have the Machloka Ben Zakkai and the Chachamim be applicable. Okay, now the Gemara continues. Amar of Yosef, Hevia Baal Edim. If the husband over here brings Edim to testify Shizinta, that the woman that he just married had an extramarital affair, meaning that while she was an Arusa, she was halachically engaged to him, she had an affair with another individual, she was unfaithful, and therefore she's subject to a death penalty. Hevia Av. And after that, the father of this woman brings a dim, v'hizimum leidei abal. And they are mezim leidei abal. They say, imano itim, you're with us. There's no way you could be testifying about this case. Then, we know that the punishment, or the way it works by edim zomimim is, kasher zamam lasot. Like they wanted to do the other party, that is the punishment that will be met out to them. So over here, they wanted to kill the woman. They wanted to subject her to a death penalty. Therefore, they will be subject to a death penalty. Edei Abal ne'aragim. They will be killed because they are edim zomimim. Ve'ein mishalmim mamon. On the other hand, they are not obligated to pay the money. Because over here, they actually cause two things to happen. They first of all caused this woman to be subject to a death penalty, but they also caused her to lose her ketubah. Because if she is indicted and then found guilty of having this extramarital affair, she will lose her ketubah. So not only do they want to kill her, they wanted to cause her to lose her ketubah over here. Now in terms of losing her ketubah, the certainty of whether she will get her ketubah is not there. She could predecease her husband and never get her ketubah. So what they're speaking about in terms of the monetary amount here is the present value of the ketubah today. If someone would buy that option value of collecting on the ketubah, what would they pay for it? But they caused her that loss of whatever that option value is, they caused her that loss. But here the Gemara says, Ein mishalmim mamon. Rabbi Yosef says they don't have to pay for that monetary expense. Rashi over here explains why. Kevan debishvila hei neragin. Since they're being killed because of her, Ein mishalmim la mamon. They're not going to pay her money. Demitchayev benafsho patur min atashlumim. Because someone who's subject to a death penalty doesn't have to pay the monetary obligations that they have. Because, as the Rashi quotes, "V'lo yeh ason anoshi anish." It's only when there's no death do they have to pay. But if there is a death, then they don't have to pay. And so over here, where they're going to be put to death for what they did to her, they don't have to compensate her for her ketubah. On the other hand, if afterwards we have another set of edim come in, this is a comedy of edim zomamim, if they have chazar ve'via bal edim, the bal now brings additional edim, and now they make the Edim of the Av into Edim Zomamim. Now these Edim of the Av were testifying and causing the Edei Abal, the first set of Edei Abal, to be put to death. Therefore, Edei Av Neragim. The Edei Av now are going to be killed because they tried to put the other Edim to death. So Kasher Zaman Lasot, they will be penalized for that. U Mishalmim Mamon, they will pay money in this case. Mamon Nezeh, Unifashot Nezeh. Money to this individual, and if I showed to that other individual. Now, the money that we're speaking about over here is the loss from the penalty that would have been imposed on the Baal. Because over there, they were causing two things to happen. When they disqualified the Edim of the Baal, they do two things. Number one is they caused those Edim to be put to death. Number two is they now caused the Baal have to pay the penalty of Motzi Shemra. The 100 shekel that is paid by the Baal as a penalty is exactly in this scenario. So these Edim that the father brought that made the edim of the bow into edim zomamim, they made that subject them to the death penalty, and they also subjected the bow to a payment for the motzi shemra. So now when it comes to their punishment is they're going to be put to death because of the death penalty they would have caused to the edim zomamim. Umishomim mamon, and I have to pay money for the money that was lost by the husband. Mamon lezeh, nifashot lezeh. And as Rabbi Yosef points out over here, it's not the same parties. The mamon is going to the bow, and the nifashot is going for the edim zomamim, that the other edim that they tried to make into edim zomamim and have them killed. Now Rashi over here says, v'imishom me'asela da'avu ba'olef sude da'av. So now we've separated the cases into two sets. One case where they get a death penalty without monetary payment, and a second case where there is a death penalty with a monetary payment. Rashi goes back now and says, wait a minute, in that first case, there was an additional monetary loss, which is that when the edim of the Baal came along and said this woman had an extramarital affair, and then the edim came in and were mezameim them, and said that these edim were problematic, imenu ait them, they did a number of things. The first set of edim tried to kill the young woman because of her extramarital affair. They took away her ketubah. So we agree there that that money is not going to be paid because they're subject to the death penalty. But they also caused a loss to the father because the father would have received the penalty from the baal for the motzi shemra. So now why don't they have to pay the father for the loss? That's a different party. Not the woman, but the father for the loss of the money or the fine that would have been paid to him. He says that's not the case, because lav alayu ramo lishlume. They're not the obligated party to pay that. El ala bao. But the husband is the one who pays it. Al shereyadana bao bao lishalem la'av. Because it's only through them that the husband has to pay. Which is that the bao by himself can't generate the necessity for a fine. The bao testifies that the woman was not a betula, and then he's found to be lying about that. He does not have to pay a penalty in that case. Because there is no penalty for motzi shemra for the baal himself testifying. The only time you pay for a penalty is if edim come and testify on behalf of the baal, and then those edim are found to be edim zomamim. And the other edim comes saying, imenu ha'itim, that's when the obligation of the baal devolves. So the first set of edim were not the ones who caused the loss of the payment for the av. Because the payment to the father for the fine only was introduced because they were made into edim zomamim. And so therefore they're not going to be held accountable for causing that loss of money because they were not the cause. The actual cause for it was the second set of edim who came along and testified that these were edim zomamim and imenu ha'item. And the reason why the husband himself doesn't pay for it is because the pasuk says, Jalokrin and Bevim, emet haya davar, if it was true that she was unfaithful, then she will be subject to a death penalty. And if it's wrong, then he has to pay the fine. That will only be true if there are witnesses involved. If he himself claims that she was unfaithful, then she won't be subject to the death penalty. If she's not subject to the death penalty, he doesn't pay the fine. So only after edim come and testify that she was unfaithful, only then do we start to introduce the possibility of a fine being paid if then those edim are disqualified. And so that's how Rashi separates between these two cases, and why the first set of edim, if they're found to be edim zomamim, will only be subject to a death penalty, no payments. And the second set of edim, on top of them, the ones that made them into edim zomamim, or that made into edim zomamim, they will not only be subject to a death penalty, but also to the monetary penalty, the money that would have been taken from the baal to pay to the av for the penalty, they will have to pay that to the baal, and they will be subject to the death penalty for the edeya baal that they tried to disqualify. Now Tosfot over here asks a question from the Gemara later on, which says that, why are these edim zomamim put to death over here? They can say, lo dechayev edei abal banu. We didn't come to put the edei abal to death. Elo dechayev abal mamon katina. We just wanted to make the husband chayev the fine. We were coming to testify about the fine part. We were not coming to subject the edim to a death penalty. Kevin shlo itru ben. Since there's no hatra'ah over here, because edim zomamim don't require hatra'ah, then why can't they make such a claim? Which the Gemara later on says with regards to edim that come to testify in the case of an ara murasa, that they could come and say that we weren't coming to put her to death because of her extramarital affair. We were simply coming to make her asura the ba'ala. And that's a fair claim. And therefore the edim can't be held accountable, meaning that if there are made into zomamim, They could say we weren't trying to bring a death penalty over here. So he says, Les Shomar, Tosfot over here differentiates and says, the Hocha Shiny, that the case over here is different. They know that the first set of Edim came to give a death penalty to the woman with the extramarital affair. So the Edim know automatically if they testify in this case, the other Edim are going to be put to death. Because that's the only thing that can happen from them doing this Hazama, which is a Muzmu, Yev Shaliot Zebelozeh. One cannot be separated from the other. Of a haltam, in that case, lo yada shaita chaverai, namely lo yada the chaver ein tzerech hatra'ah. They were lacking a piece of knowledge or information, and therefore they could separate between the pieces of information, say, we really weren't coming about a capital case. We're just coming to say that this woman shouldn't be together with her husband anymore. And therefore they could separate between the two issues. Vamar of Yosef, you have another statement from Yosef, ploni riva'o l'onso. If an individual comes and testifies that this person sodomized him and he was raped, and that it was against his will that he was sodomized, huvacher, the victim, and another witness, mitzarfim lahargo, they can join together to be a kate dim and testify against the perpetrator of this sodomization and put him to death. If, on the other hand, the victim comes along and says, yes, I was sodomized by so-and-so, but Lirtzono, I was a willing participant in that. Rashahu, he is a Rasha. Ve HaTorah Amra, Al Tashet Rasha Aid. And the Torah says that you can't make a Rasha into an aid. Now that's based on the Pasuk in Mishpatim that says, Lo Tisa Shema Shav, Al Tashet Yadchaim Rasha Liot Aid Hamas. And so the Gemara reorganizes the words in the Pasukim to say, Al Tashet Rasha liot aid. Don't make a rasha into an aid. That's the drasha that's there. And so therefore this person who is deemed to be a rasha because he incriminated himself by saying that he was a willing participant in this act of sodomy. So therefore he now disqualified himself from being a witness because he's a rasha. And so now if he comes to testify this individual along with another party to put the sodomizer to death, that won't work because he's a disqualified aid. Rova Amar, Rova says that's not true. Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo. A person is a relative to himself. Ve'en Adam Misim Atzmo Rasha. And a person cannot make himself into a Rasha. So a person's unable or incapable to make himself into a Rasha because his testimony is about himself. And since he's considered to be a karov vis-a-vis himself, just like any other karov would be disqualified in this case, he's also disqualified. So what's going to happen here is we're not going to believe him with regards to the fact that he was a willing participant in this sodomization. And so we will do, as the Gemara is going to say in a second, palgina dibura, we bifurcate his statement, and we say that we believe you with regards to the fact that this individual is involved in the sodomization. We do not believe you with regards to the part that you were the willing participant in that act of sodomy. And so therefore he and another party can come along and testify against the sodomizer and have him be put to death. So Rova disagrees with Rabbi Yosef and says that we invoke this principle of Pagin and Dibura. And that Pagin and Dibura allows us to then convict the sodomizer, even though the passive participant was a willing participant in the act. Nevertheless, we don't believe him with regards to that statement. And we do believe him with regards to the statement about the perpetrator of the sodomization. And so therefore, this individual, along with another aid, can put that person to death. And we don't have a problem of Al Tashet Rasha aid, because he's not classified as a Rasha, because Ein Adam Misim Atzmo Rasha. Over here, there are a number of issues to deal with. The first of which is that later on in the Gemara, there's going to be a machlok between Rova and Abaye as to which individuals are disqualified from being edim. The pasuk says, "Al tashed yadchai marshaliot aid Hamas." So the focus on Hamas, on theft and robbery, might mean that only in that type of rasha do we worry about their testimony. The reason being is that this person has demonstrated a disregard for other people's property, as well as the fact that they're willing to do things or violate the Torah for money. And now that would bring us into a great suspicion about their testimony that they could be bribed. They could be paid off, or they might have ulterior motives over here. And Rova is of the opinion over there that a Rasha of Hamas is the only individual who is disqualified from being an eight. That would imply that other Averot would not disqualify you from being an Eight, even though you are maybe considered to be a Rasha, but you need a Rasha of Hamas to be disqualified as an Eight. So here the Balei Tosafot come up with a number of ways to answer over here why Rava has to say, in Adam Asim Etzmo Rasha, even though according to Rava, this wouldn't be a Rasha that is disqualified from Eidut. So the first thing Tosafot says is, Kevan Shover Lahanato, since this is a violation of something that's Ochel Nevelot the Teabon, someone who is willing to violate Averot, even wantonly, because of their desires, just like for physical pleasure, he would disregard any laws, so to then, maybe for monetary reward, he would also do things that were improper. And so what Tosafot says is that this individual is willing to violate the Averot for his pleasure is in the category of an Eid Hamas, or in the category of a Rasha of Hamas, because he's willing to do things or violate things for his own benefit, just like this other person who, for money, will do anything. This person for Hana'ah will do anything, and maybe that's the same thing. For the Hana'ah of money, he would do it then, even though over here he's only demonstrating that he'll do it for Hana'ah Gufo. Tosafot gives two other answers. One answer is that, by Arayot, we do not disqualify the individual, because over there, there is such a strong drive that the individual is overcome by the desire and therefore sins, but in a case where they're tempted by money, that would not be the case. But by the situation of sodomization, there isn't a sufficient amount of hana'ah involved to say that the person was overwhelmed by the hana'ah in order to engage in such activity, and therefore they would not be considered to be exempt from the fact that their desires drove them. Or inami, the last possibility is, hanenami yitzro tokfo v'kashur le'edut acheret v'lo aridia. And when we say that someone involved in rayot is kasher le'edut, they're kasher v'edut in other areas, but not in the area of arayot. Meaning, in the area of arayot, they are suspect, and we will disqualify them in that particular silo of testimony. But with regards to other matters, we will let them testify. And so if that's what it means, that by arayot or strong desires, we say the person was just overwhelmed or overcome, that is to say that they are not disqualified in other areas of testimony. But in that area, they will be disqualified, and so too over here. By the case of the sodomization, even though that's not an Eid Hamas, nevertheless, because this person gives in to his desires, that means that in this area, he won't be believed because his desires will drive him and not proper thinking. Whereas in other areas, he can separate or segregate that from his desires here, and those areas he will be believed. So those are the three ways that Tosafot deals with this position of Rava here to reconcile the position of Rava here with that position of Rava later on in the Masechta. The other thing that Tosafot discusses over here is how or when do we say Pagira Dibura? How much can you parse away at the words of the individual in order to say that, oh, we believe half of his testimony and not the other half of his testimony? So for instance, over here where he says, Pani Rava, oh, there it's so no. He says that so-and-so sodomized him, but he was a willing participant in that act. How do we look at his statement over here? Tosafot says, don't think that the way that we're doing this is we are parsing his words and saying that we believe the part where he says, Ploni Rivao, that so-and-so sodomized. Lir so-no, we drop, and we say that's not the case, and we don't believe him that he was a willing participant, and we say that he was a victim and not a willing participant. Tosafot says, don't say that. And you know, when Tosafot says, don't say that, that means that there are other Rishonim, like the Ravid, who believe that that is the case. And that the idea of Pagin and Dibura is literally that. We look at his statement, and we see if we can parse out his statement. Can we cut off his statement at a certain point, accept a part of that testimony, and drop the rest of the wording and the rest of the statement? And that's what Pagin and Dibura is, for the Ravid and others that believe like that. That would mean that how you said it or how you phrased it will make a difference as to the Pagina Dibura. The Tosafot rejects that and says that Pagina Dibura has to do with what we call gufa. How many objects are involved in the situation? We will say Pagina Dibura when we are talking about two separate objects. So in our instance over here, the individual is saying that so-and-so sodomized, and then the second object is here is the one who's testifying saying, he says, I was a participant willingly in that act. So now, you're talking about two different individuals. One is the individual who perpetrated the sodomization. The other one is the aide, who was the passive participant in that act, who says that I did it willingly. So in that case, we'll bifurcate it and say the perpetrator of the sodomization was true, but he did it to someone else. He didn't do it to this individual because we can separate the object. In that case, we'll say pagin and dibura. In a case where it's the same parties, we will not say pagin and dibura. For instance, we had a case in Baba Batra, we saw this in Ketubot as well, where he didn't come and testify and say, yes, that is our handwriting on the document, but we were under duress when we signed on it. We were tanim, we were minors when we signed on it. They qualify their signatures, but then they, in the same sentence, say that their signatures are invalid or disqualified because of another reason. So over there, we say that their signatures are no good because their statement verifying their signatures also disqualified their signatures at the same time. So Tosafot says, why don't we say Pagin and Dibura? We'll believe them with regards to their verification of their signatures. We won't believe them with regards to the fact that they were under duress or they did this when they were Ketanim, that they did something wrong. We'll just carve that out and say no. So Tosafot says that's different over there because it's Guf Echad. It's one object that we're speaking about there. There we're speaking about the Edim themselves. The same Edim are saying about their signatures that they're verifying, but they're also saying that they did something wrong at the same time. There you can't be Pagin and Dibura. You can't say that we did sign it, but we weren't Ketanim. Or we did sign it, and we weren't under duress. Because that's all about the same party or a Guf Echad. So Tosfot says that Pagin and Dibura depends on objects, the number of objects that we're looking at. Whereas the Raivid says that it has to do with the language, if we can parse the language. And so it's important then the phrasing of it, not just how many objects are involved. And the explanation of the right position is that when it comes to Ein Adam L'Sim Atzmo Rasha, then it's as if that statement or any statement that involved that individual himself wasn't said. So we drop that part of the statement and then we just keep the portion of the statement that was relevant. Amar Rava, so now we have another statement from Rava, Ploni Bal Ishti. If a husband comes and testifies that so-and-so slept with his wife, Huvacher, the husband, and another witness can be mitzterfim, or go, to put the adulterer to death, avalolo harga, but not to put his wife to death. Micah Mashmalan, what's that teaching us? That we bifurcate his statement, and we believe him with regards to the adulterer, but we don't believe him with regards to his wife? Hainuach, didn't we just say that? Didn't Rava just say over here, Pagin and Dibura, with regards to the case of Ploni Rav O, the Ritzono? What's different about that case than this case? It's the same situation in which we bifurcate a statement. We believe him with regards to the third party. We don't believe him with regards to himself or with regards to his wife. So Ma'udatayim, the Gemara says, Adam Krovitz, Alatzmo, Amrinan, when it comes to an individual vis-a-vis himself, there he's considered to be a Karov. Etelishto lo amrinan. By his wife, we will not classify him as being a karov. Now remember that a wife is not a classic type of karov, a karov in a blood sense. It's a karov because of the marriage that ensued, meaning that the halakhic construct is what makes them into karovim. So you could possibly think that over here, the person is not considered to be a karov. Etelishto. And as the Balei Tosfot point out over here, of course, he is a karov to his wife, as we're going to see later on the Masechta. But what we will invoke here is a migo. Migo that he's believed with regards to the adulterer, he should also be believed vis-a-vis his wife. And since he's believed to kill the adulterer, he should also be believed to kill his wife. And that migo will overcome the quote-unquote relationship between the husband and the wife. Obviously, vis-a-vis himself, he can't do that. Can't say the migo that he's believed with regards to the perpetrator of the sodomization. He's also believed about himself that he was a willing participant because then he's testifying directly about himself. But the other case where he testifies about the adulterer and then as a result of that or a consequence of that testimony, it also implicates his wife who will be put to death. Maybe over there we allow the migo to overcome that. Kamash Malan, that we don't say that and Adam is considered to be a karov el itzel ishto, like he is considered to be a karov itzel atzmo. And just from a Musar Ashkofik standpoint, it's a beautiful idea that a person vis-a-vis his wife, the relationship he has with his wife is the same as the relationship that he has with himself. And meaning that the person has to treat his wife as an extension of himself, and that the care and concern and consideration that a person would have for themselves, they would have to have for their wife as well, because she's considered to be, like we say in many places, ishto kegufo. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines down on the top of Yud Amud Aleph.